Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where John Howard makes a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. On this occasion, on the publication of his book, John Howard, The Menzies Era, which is only just out. Mr. Howard is perhaps the best known Australian, so I'll introduce him very briefly. Of course, he was the 25th Prime Minister of Australia, serving from March 1996 until December 2007, which makes him the second longest Prime Minister in Australian history after Robert Menzies. In his life as an author, Mr. Howard has written Lazarus Rising about his own government, and now he's at the Sydney Institute to talk about the Menzies era, the government of Robert Menzies. John Howard, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much, Gerard. And can I start by thanking the Sydney Institute again for providing an opportunity for me to talk about a book I've written. But more importantly, it gives me an opportunity to salute the work of the Sydney Institute. Running what is colloquially called a think tank for a very, very long period of time has been quite an achievement by Gerard and Anne Henderson, and I compliment them for it. It's a very objective body. It provides a forum for all shades of political opinion, within reason, of course. I mean, I think that's very, very important, because one of the things that I say in this book, and one of the things that I always felt very strongly was a characteristic of Bob Menzies, was that he was very interested in the battle of ideas. And politics is, in the end, a battle of ideas. And the contest of ideas is the contest, more than anything else, that shapes our society. This book is not a personal biography of Robert Gordon Menzies. It is certainly not a hagiography of Robert Gordon Menzies. It is an attempt, albeit from a position of natural respect, regard and admiration, to assess a period in Australian history which was dominated by one man in a way that no person since Federation has dominated any period in Australian politics. The Menzies era deserves a proper and fair assessment for a number of reasons. Menzies, of course, was, as Gerard said, the longest serving Prime Minister in Australian history. He won 7 elections. The period covered by this book starts in 1949 and ends in 1972 with Gough Whitlam's election as Prime Minister, thus ending 23 years of unbroken coalition government, a longevity in government that will not, in my view, ever be repeated in Australia's experience. We won't have, again, a party in power for that long. What the book endeavours to do is to touch on what I regard as the major events, personalities and shifts in public opinion and public attitudes in Australia during the time that Menzies was Prime Minister, between 1949 and 1966, and then the 3 Liberal successors of his, Harold Holt, John Gorton, and Bill McMahon, and then it ends appropriately with a chapter entitled It's Time, dash, but only just, in 1972, because one of the things I endeavour to do in this book is to demolish some myths about Australian politics. And one of the myths is that although Gough Whitlam's win in 1972 was a handsome one because he ended 23 years of coalition government, it wasn't a very emphatic win. His margin was only 9 seats. But let me say immediately that you will find the last chapter complimentary of Gough Whitlam, because I thought he was a very successful opposition leader, and he did a remarkable thing in getting the Labor Party fit for government in 1972. The first chapter in the book is called At the Pictures in Earlwood, and that's because I grew up in Earlwood and I was at the pictures with my mother and father and one of my older brothers when I first learnt that Menzies was likely to become the next Prime Minister, because during the showing of the second film, we called them films then, not movies, the second film, which was an American war movie called Command Decision, and naturally, of course, indicated that America had won the war single-handedly, but that was in the nature of war movies. And there was a little slide that said, LCP takes early poll lead. And when we got home, my eldest brother, Wal, was sitting in front of this big radio in our lounge room, and he said, Menzies has won and the biggest swing's been in Queensland. Years later, when I won in 1996, the biggest swing was in Queensland. Queensland was always very generous to our side of politics, although they missed the beat rather badly in 2007, but that, is another matter. I do have, after that, and the purpose of that chapter is to really describe what I remember about Australia in 1949. I was then 10 years of age, and one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book was that the period of the Menzies era coincided neatly with my own acquaintance at the age of 10 with politics. I remember there was a vacant allotment or paddock across the road from our house in Earlwood, and there was a shed put up there by the local Labor Party campaign. And the local Labor member then was a fellow called Dan Mulcahy, and we were in the federal seat of Lang. And Dan Mulcahy was a very prosperous and successful publican who lived in the eastern suburbs of Sydney. And the Liberals used to say he only came at election time and shouted the bar in order to get re-elected. Now, that was very unfair, because I think from what I've read and been told, he was a very conscientious local member. And I, from then on, acquired tremendous interest in politics, and all of the events that are canvassed in this book are ones that I remember from 1949 onwards, of course, remember from my own childhood and then young adulthood and so forth. I do have a couple of chapters that start with Menzies' early life in Japarit and his rapid rise in politics. He, of course, as you all know, became Prime Minister in 1939. At the death of Joseph Lyons, and then because of crumbling internal support he felt obliged to resign in 1941. He was replaced by Arthur Fadden, who lasted for 40 days and 40 nights, and then he in turn, as a result of a baton change, was replaced by John Curtin, and Curtin then went on to win a very handsome, indeed overwhelming victory in 1943. And one of the interesting things that's forgotten about Whitlam's win in 1972, not only did he win for the first time for the Labor Party since, or take them into office for the first time in 23 years, but he also, it was the first time I think in 43 years, if my mathematics is correct, did you have a Labor leader winning at the polls from opposition, because Curtin had won not as initially as an election, but as a result of the two independents shifting their support. Now, I then trace Menzies' remarkable resurrection, his formation of the Liberal Party of Australia. And the Liberal Party of Australia, if you judge by elections won, has been the most successful political party in Australia's history. He rated that his greatest political achievement. I don't think there's any doubt about that, his greatest political achievement. He had great achievements as a statesman and a leader, which is separate from his political achievements, although not unrelated. And he then went on, of course, to win in 1949. One of the things I've dwelt on quite heavily, because I think historically it's very important and its significance is often overlooked, was the titanic struggle between Chifley and Menzies over the attempt by Chifley to nationalise the private trading banks. Now, that failed. It was struck down in the High Court, and that decision was confirmed by the Privy Council. But it's worth reflecting for a moment what might have been the nature of post-war Australia economically if all the banks had been in the hands of the government. I think the structure and nature and direction of our economy would have been very, very different. I thought that the major motivation of writing this book was my belief that the contribution of that Menzies period to the nature of modern Australia has been, how shall I put it, not so much discounted but overlooked or undervalued. And if you look at the character of modern Australia, there is so much of it that can be traced back to what was achieved during that period or what occurred during that period. Not all of it. We're a different country now from what we were in 1949, 1960, 1970, indeed 1980. But some of the fundamentals are ones that you can connect during that period. There's not much doubt that the 1950s, a much derided decade and a much sneered at decade because of its claimed social conformity and stultifying social repression and so forth, the 1950s is really the first decade of the 20th century in which large numbers of average Australians, of working class, lower middle class Australians, really got a share of the good life. Let me illustrate, for example, in 1949, home ownership in Australia was just under 50%. By 1970, it was close to 70%. Now, that was an extraordinary transformation. And interestingly enough, through all of that period, it was possible to service a housing loan at a medium cost in one of the capital cities of Australia out of one income. And you only have to state that to understand how much the transformation has been since then in relation to the affordability of housing, but also to remind ourselves of what an enormous change occurred during that period. It was a time of extraordinarily low unemployment. Unemployment in 1972 was just under 2%. It was a time of very strong economic growth. It was also a time, of course, when, particularly in the early 1950s, that, and I was very conscious of this because my father owned a garage, or service station as they now call them, where there was an absolute explosion in owning cars. In 1950, the number of Australians who owned cars was quite small. By 1955, it had just expanded in an exponential way. Now, in mentioning these things, I of course acknowledge that not all of these developments were entirely due to actions of the government. Some of them were a natural product of the bounce back of the world economy and the Australian economy as a result of the end of World War II. But many of them were due to the government. Many of the changes were due to the sense of stability and prosperity that the government created, and also due to the capacity of the government to respond to unexpected economic developments. One of the tests, and I can say this from my own experience in government, one of the tests of a successful government is how you respond when you get an unexpected development. And, for example, we faced unexpected developments with the Asian financial meltdown in 1997-98. The Hawke government faced adverse developments with the terms of trade challenge and crisis in the mid-1980s. On both of those occasions, I think the two governments, one coalition disposition, the other of Labor identity, responded correctly and effectively to those challenges. Menzies faced a big challenge at the time of the Korean War. There was a huge explosion of inflation because of the wool boom during the Korean War. The Americans bought up all our wool for uniforms for the Korean War, and inflation went to 23% in 1 year. And because of a combination of measures, one of them being an ingenious temporary tax system that Arthur Fadden introduced, which creamed off some of the graziers' proceeds of selling the wool and applied it against their future tax liabilities. That was his alternative to agreeing to an appreciation of the Australian pound, which was being advocated by the Treasury and also by other people in the government. And the other contribution that was made to taking inflation out of the system was an inspired decision by the then Conciliation and Arbitration Court, as it was then called, in the early 1950s, to suspend cost of living adjustments, which guaranteed that the inflation burst would not be built into the wage fixation system. Much of the book, of course, concerns issues of what we now call national security. Throughout the whole of this period, indeed right up until the late 1960s, the issue that dominated the world more than anything else was, of course, fear of communism. You talk about communism now to people under the age of 50, and they look at you in blank disbelief. There are now only five countries in the world that call themselves communist. One of them is, of course, China, and more than 50% of China's GDP is in private hands. But nonetheless, it is a self-described communist country. And it is impossible to understand the politics of this period without understanding the communist issue and understanding the extraordinary success Menzies had in capturing the mood of the period in relation to communism and also the way in which he effectively exploited it against his Labour opponents. I deal extensively with the Communist Party referendum in 1951, in which a couple of people quite close to me get honourable mentions. One of them is my mother, who for the first and only time in her life, as I understand it, voted differently from my father. They were both staunch liberals, but Mum didn't agree with the referendum proposal of Menzies to ban the Communist Party. And not that she had any sympathy for the Communist Party, she just sort of didn't like the idea of banning a political party. And so they agreed to go their separate ways, and I remember a rather tense but short exchange over the kitchen table about the different voting intentions of my parents. And the other person, of course, who voted no and was his first ever vote was my friend Michael Bohm, who is here tonight and who indicated to me that he'd be very happy if I made that extraordinary disclosure in my book. I, of course, deal in some detail with the Great Labour Split of 1955, which cast a very long shadow over the Labour Party and indeed over Australian politics. And the chapter on the election in 1961, where Menzies almost lost, he was elected with a majority of only two and one after the Speaker, was put in place. I entitled that chapter as Saved by Santa Maria, because there's no doubt that the faithful flow of Democratic Labor Party preferences in Victoria saved the Menzies government from otherwise certain defeat at that election. One of the issues that I have dwelt in some detail in the book relates to Australia's relations with Asia. One of the many myths about recent Australian politics is the proposition that our engagement with the Asian region really only began in earnest 30 or 40 years ago. It's important to make the observation that in two very crucial areas, engagement with Asia began in the Menzies years. The first, of course, was the inauguration of the Colombo Plan, And you've got to remember the Colombo plan, whereby many students from Asian countries came to Australian universities at a time when the university infrastructure of most Asian countries was very poor, has had a lasting and beneficial impact on our relations with many countries. The other very important event was the signing of the commerce agreement with Japan in 1957. And that was only 12 years after the end of World War II, and feelings towards the Japanese in Australia 12 years after the end of World War II were still very bitter and intense. But despite that, the Menzies government pressed ahead and negotiated that agreement. And it's right to say that the person more than anybody else in the government who was responsible for that, it was John McEwen, the trade minister, and a year after the agreement was signed, the person who became the deputy prime minister and leader of the Country Party. And there's no doubt in my mind that McEwen was far and away the most influential figure in the Menzies years, apart from Menzies himself. The foresight of that agreement is quite remarkable, because it was signed in 1957, and there's a neat symmetry in that, because 1957 was also the year in which the Treaty of Rome was signed, and the Treaty of Rome was the foundation document of the European Common Market and ultimately the foundation document of the European Union. And although we didn't start selling our resources in earnest to Japan until some years after that agreement was signed, it established a basis of goodwill and a gateway into that country, so that when we discovered resources in Western Australia, iron ore and the like, we were able to enter into very fruitful negotiations and understandings with the Japanese. And of course, Japan over the years has been our best and most faithful customer in Asia. And by 1970, Japan had well and truly replaced Britain as our principal export destination. And the foresight of McEwen and Menzies at that time was remarkable. The agreement with Japan was opposed by the Labor Party. Everett made a very, I think, xenophobic speech about threats to Australian jobs and the like. And in fact, in some respects, his opposition to it was fiercer than that of the RSL. Although many sections of the RSL were unhappy about it, the national leadership of the RSL at that time showed a great deal of foresight. So I regard those things as important to be put in the balance when you're looking at our relations with Asia. I acknowledge, of course, that further on, in relation to the recognition of China, recognition of Beijing as the legitimate government of China, that Gough Whitlam, particularly as a result of his thoughtful visit to China in the early 70s, showed a lot more foresight on that issue and absolutely wrong-footed the coalition government at the time. But when you're looking at the balance of those things, it is fair to keep in mind the enormous significance of what was done in relation to the Colombo Plan and also in relation to the trade agreement. There are a couple of non-economic and non-national security areas, of course, where Menzies was very, very significant. I think in the area of education, the two things for which he should be long remembered were the initiatives in the late 1950s as a result of the Murray Report of massively increasing Commonwealth assistance for universities. When I was at university between 1957 and 1961, it was only a relatively small percentage of the Australian population that had the opportunity of a university education. And as a result of Menzies' initiatives in that area, those opportunities were significantly expanded. The other big breakthrough, of course, was in the area of state aid for independent, predominantly Catholic schools. This had been something that had been festering for a very long time. And the breakthrough, the decision that Menzies took in the 1963 election to offer as an initial contribution of state aid, £5 million for the construction of new science blocks to be made available without discrimination as between government and independent schools. And it was an extraordinarily courageous initiative at the time, particularly as the opposition Labor Party, which until then had enjoyed overwhelming electoral support from most people of Irish Catholic background in Australia, not because of any religious principles or religious considerations, but simply because historically that section of the population had been more heavily identified with the working class and naturally had supported the Labor Party. And it was extraordinary when I look back on it and think about it, and I lived through those times and was involved in some of the debates inside my own party about it, that it took, as he called himself, a simple Presbyterian to initiate this giant breakthrough on an issue which had contributed to a much deeper sectarian feeling in our community than was later to prevail, and thankfully has disappeared almost completely from our society. And it was a very significant breakthrough. Another often forgotten initiative of Menzies of a social dimension was to, for the first time, to provide government assistance to non-government, largely church organisations that provided aged care facilities. It was during those Menzies years in the 1950s that the first aged persons assistance legislation was inaugurated. The longest chapter in the book is about the Vietnam War, because the Vietnam War was the most divisive, difficult, agonising issue that Australia had during that period. I indicate in the book that in the context in which the decision was taken, that if I had been in Menzies' position in 1965, I'd have taken the same decision that he took. It was an issue that did divide the Australian community. It was an issue where Arthur Calwell's speech in 1965 opposing the dispatch of an infantry battalion was demonstrated in the fullness of time to have been remarkably prescient, as he said that he, amongst other things, he was opposed to the decision because he did not want to see America humiliated in Vietnam. And of course the reality was that when the decision was taken to commit our forces, nobody imagined that America would be other than victorious in that conflict. And it's worth remembering that, and that those many of you in the room who will have lived through that period will understand the import of that. And it's also worth remembering that in the early years the decision was warmly supported in the Australian community. Harold Holt's victory in 1966 over Arthur Calwell and the Labor Party was overwhelming, and one of the principal reasons for that was the public's view that the decision that had been taken to commit our force to Vietnam was correct. I detail briefly the prime ministerships of Harold Holt, John Gorton and Bill McMahon. The Liberal Party, of course, after Holt's sudden death on the 17th of December 1967, entered into a period of considerable instability. I remember those events very well. I was not in Parliament, but I was an active member of the Liberal Party. I didn't want Gorton to succeed Holt. I wanted Hasler to succeed Holt. But I have to confess, as the years went by and I got to know him more, particularly after I'd become a Prime Minister, I developed what I might perhaps call some retrospective regard, even affection, for some of the characteristics of John Gorton. I think it's fair to say that when he was elected, there was a sense of excitement in the Australian community. His palpable Australian nationalism, I entitled the chapter on him as the Tory larrikin, because he was an interesting combination. A man who had very traditional views on lots of things, but also had a demeanour that was, as he called it himself, Australian to the boot heels. And but he, as I indicate in the book, he didn't understand how important the relationship between a Prime Minister and his immediate colleagues was to the maintenance of the Prime Minister's hold on power. I have to say, based a little bit on field evidence of my own and others, that the relationship between a Prime Minister and the people he immediately leads is about the most important relationship that the Prime Minister can have. And if you lose the confidence of the people immediately around you, you fall into not only error but also great difficulty. Harold Holt was somebody who demonstrated very clearly the priority he placed on our relations with Asia. He was probably the first Prime Minister of Australia to have visited countries in our region before he visited Washington or London. Although other Prime Ministers who have followed, that including myself, visited capitals in our region before visiting London and Washington. Not that he or I had any objection to Washington or London. They're terrific places to visit, but there is an importance in symbolism and the symbolism of that, because he undertook a major tour of the region after he became Prime Minister, was very important. I guess it's fair to say that of all the former ministers in Menzies governments that I interviewed for the book, and I interviewed Jim Forbes, Doug Anthony, Peter Nixon, Malcolm Fraser and Tom Hughes, although Tom was not a minister in the Menzies government, he was a minister in John Gorton's government and in my judgment a very, very good Attorney General, and also in my judgment unfairly dismissed from the ministry when McMahon became Prime Minister. It's fair to say that they were all of the view that the coalition had no hope of winning the 1972 election. The one exception to that was that Doug Anthony told me, and it was reported in the press at the time, that after the budget of August 1972 was brought down, he urged McMahon and Snedden, who was then the Deputy Leader and Treasurer, to go to the polls immediately because he thought he could fight the election on the strength of the budget, which was quite well received, but if you waited a bit longer, the election would be seen as a contest between Whitlam and McMahon, and he did not believe that McMahon could win that contest. In the final analysis, the election was not held until December, and as everybody knows, lost. Now, in summary, what were Menzies' great skills as a political leader and as a public figure? He had presence, he had style, he was, in my view, the best political orator. He's certainly the best political orator I've ever heard. I thought he had a remarkable capacity to rate, to effortlessly say what many other people thought. He understood that politics was a battle of ideas. He used the modern jargon, he was a conviction politician. He understood that unless you got into power, you couldn't do anything. But once you had power, you had to do something, otherwise you might lose that power. He was an aggressive political campaigner. If he spotted a weakness in a political opponent, he was ruthless and relentless in exploiting that weakness. But he was also somebody who understood that every so often the public would like to see nothing of you as Prime Minister. Every so often it's a good idea for a Prime Minister to completely disappear. It's much harder now with social media. Of course, you've got to remember there was no television in until 1956, 7 years after he'd become Prime Minister. There was no talkback radio. Until well into the 60s, my understanding. You had the odd opinionated radio commentator, but actual talkback radio, one mention of the Bohm family unite is enough. But you didn't have talkback radio and things that have such an enormous impact. But he had that remarkable capacity to sense that the public occasionally wanted a rest from both politics and also their Prime Minister, however much they may have respected him. Did he make mistakes? Plenty. All Prime Ministers do. The important trick, I suppose, or skill in public office is to get the big things right. And he was very successful in getting the big things right. He, of course, retired at his own time, on his own terms. And that itself was a significant compliment to him. He understood the extraordinary value of the coalition. And he said when he retired that the coalition was fundamental to his success. It was something that was also the very strong view of Malcolm Fraser, who ran a very effective coalition, and it was also my view and my experience. And I've often said that I owe a great deal to Tim Fisher, John Anderson and Mark Vaile, who were the three successive country or National Party leaders during my time as Prime Minister. But I think above everything else, he understood the national security dimension of Australian politics. National security, they didn't call it then, they call it that then, they call it defence and foreign affairs. But national security has always been a very important thing in Australian politics, and he understood the nature of the communist issue in the early 1950s far better than did his Labor opponents, and he used that very effectively. And of course it was during his time as Prime Minister that the ANZUS Treaty was signed between Australia and New Zealand and the United States. Now, ladies and gentlemen, as I said at the beginning, this is neither a biography in a personal sense or a hagiography of Robert Menzies. It's a book written with significant respect and admiration for what he achieved. It's designed to put a case for a greater recognition of the contribution that his leadership and those around him during those years made to the building of modern Australia. And if it does that, I will be well pleased. Thank you.
So many thanks to John Howard. I should also say thanks to Clayton Yutz for the use of this great facility this evening. And Janet Grundy's got copies of John Howard's The Menzies Era, and I'm sure Mr. Howard would be happy to sign copies after the event if he hasn't done. He's done some already. So we come to questions and discussion. We've got till the top of the hour, so we've got plenty of time. We keep our comments brief. Can I just lead off? You mentioned the Robert Menzies successors, Holt, Gorton, McMahon, Snedden, and then later Fraser, but I think it's fair to say from what he himself said in that interview with David McNichol that Menzies had either a little time for or was quite disappointed with all of them. Was that a realistic assessment in your view, or was it a factor of his increasing age and illness by the mid-70s, or do you think it was fair enough that he looked back and felt disappointed in those who'd come after him?
Well, I can't put myself in his mind as to what his reasons were for saying that. I think it is true. I think it's probably not the case that he had a disappointment about Holt, because the poor man only lasted 21 months. I don't think he would have been a fan of Gorton's, because he would have seen Gorton as too antagonistic to the Federalist principles of states' rights, whatever you want to call it. And it's well understood that he did not enjoy a good relationship with McMahon. But as to the depth or otherwise of those feelings, I can't really attest. I can only observe and speculate.
Just stay there. Yes, so there's a question here, yeah.
I have a question. How could a modern Prime Minister absence himself?
How could a modern Prime Minister go away for a while?
Well, I use it metaphorically. It just means that you don't have to be on the media every night. You certainly couldn't go away to the cricket for 6 months. I got into trouble once for being at Lord's for a day. It's very, very, but it's different now. It's very different. But you've also got to understand that everything then was relative, and that he did have that capacity to understand that if things were going well, you just sort of dropped out of the picture. You sensed it. I think that's a very good lesson, even in modern times, a very good idea just to let people run their own lives.
Especially here.
Robert Menzies retired in January 1966. What do you think it says about Menzies that in that almost 50 years, he is the last one that went at a time and place of his own choosing?
Well, it probably means on that issue he's better than anybody else. I don't think there's any doubt about that. No doubt at all, but you've also got to remember that Menzies faced, in my view, the Labor leaders he faced. He defeated Chifley. Chifley was a well-loved figure, a revered figure in the Labor movement, but showed very bad political judgment on the bank nationalisation issue because, amongst other things, the jobs of thousands of loyal trade unionists were threatened by that decision, and you had the spectacle in the lead-up to that 1949 election of many bank employees who belonged to unions campaigning against the Labor government, and I don't think he showed very good judgment on that. Evatt, of course, was a very unsuccessful Labor leader who developed a view after the 1954 election that the Petrov affair was a conspiracy involving ASIO and the Menzies government, and he became, and of course I think Evatt more than anybody else was responsible for the Labor Party split in 1955. Arthur Calwell went very close to winning in 1961, but there was something about the public's judgment of the contest between the two of them that resulted in Menzies in 1963 recovering very well. But you can't take it away from him. He was the only one who did that. So on that score, he's better than any of us.
But he was older too. Well, he was 72, wasn't he?
71.
71.
Yeah, he was. Yeah, that's true. He was older. And I guess 71 then is perhaps in a sense older than 71 now, isn't it? I hope so.
Michael.
In support of your mother's view...
Yes.
..on the Communist Party dissolution bill, is there any real evidence that he didn't initiate that within Cabinet and that the Country Party leaders were the promoters?
No, there's no, that's untrue. You can't blame the Country Party for that. You can't. I mean, the situation was that he changed the policy of the Liberal Party before the 1949 election. And he went to the 1949 election with a policy to ban the Communist Party. And as soon as he got in, he introduced a bill. And the bill was passed through the Parliament, ultimately with the support of the Labor Party. I think what helped cost him that referendum result was that the question that was put was too complicated. If he had simply said, in effect, with the right language, we want you to alter the Constitution so that the bill that the High Court declared invalid would no longer be invalid. If he'd just stuck to that, it would have been hard for Evatt to campaign against it, because he'd have been campaigning against something for which his party had voted in the Parliament. But instead of that, the referendum question included some add-ons, and you had the spectacle of somebody like Zelman Cowan, who wasn't a member of the Liberal Party but was seen as a conservative academic, wrote a very trenchant criticism of it and came out against it, and it divided the Liberal Party. People like Alan Misson and Ivor Greenwood in Victoria, They came out against it. Gordon Barton, who was then the president of the Sydney University Liberal Club, left the Liberal Party and remained forever out of the Liberal Party's result. Of course, it caused some fracturing on the Labor side. Many of the groupers in Victoria were open in their desire to see the referendum carried. But I think the suggestion that he was somehow or other tricked or dragooned into doing it is quite wrong. He changed his mind, I think, because he sensed the feeling in the community. And of course, you've got to remember, in the late 1940s, the mid to late 1940s, the communist influence in trade unions went very close to getting the numbers at the interstate executive of the ACTU.
So, question here, and then Richard, and then Stephen. Just stay here, will you?
Sorry, I keep moving around, sorry.
Mr. Howes, as I think I told you once, I only ever met Menzies once, and he told me as a 13-year-old schoolboy, when I asked him if he would like to put his signature beside Keith Miller's on my school leave pass, he told me that I was a little horror. However, he proceeded to kindly give it to me. He was very fond of quips and debate. What do you think were his best remark or two?
They're legend. I think there are two people who, in my time in politics, had the good quips. So I remember Menzies, of course. He wasn't in my time, and Whitlam had some good ones too. I think that wonderful one where the woman calls out, "I wouldn't vote for you if the Archangel Gabriel," and he said, "Well, if the Archangel Gabriel, you wouldn't be in my constituency." That wasn't bad. But for even-handedness, and given that this is an equal opportunity think tank, I still think one that rivals that was Gough Whitlam and Ron McAuliffe, who was president of the Queensland Rugby League, walking onto that field in Brisbane in the Rugby League Grand Final in 1975 to a chorus of boos, and Whitlam drawing himself to his not inconsiderable height, turning around and saying, "McAuliffe, if I'd have known you were that unpopular, I wouldn't have come."
Now, you met Menzies once.
I met Menzies once, and at a cocktail party at the Lodge, and it was traditional for the Federal Council of the Liberal Party to the members thereof to attend a cocktail party at the Lodge, and I met him once. I was then a member of the New South Wales delegation, and there was the other leaders of the Young Liberal Movement from the other states, and we had a brief discussion. He was the consummate professional, and we would never have won the election without the votes of the young, and he did a magnificent job, all of that. He said all the right things. He was a great professional, but that was the beginning and the end of it. I heard him speak on two occasions at public gatherings, one at the old Palace Theatre in Canterbury Road, Canterbury, in Sydney that is, not Melbourne, and in 1955, and again at the Ashfield Town Hall in 1963, which was his last general election. They did have a half Senate election a year later. So I didn't really know him, except in the same way that most people knew him. I read about him in the papers, saw him on television, heard him on the radio. And incidentally, although he said he didn't like television, I thought he was hugely effective on television. He seemed to fill the screen, both metaphorically and physically.
So we're going to go to Richard and then Stephen.
Could you talk a little bit about the culture of states' rights at the time of Menzies and how that has changed since that time of centralisation?
Question about the culture of states' rights at the time of Menzies and what changes.
Well, it was much more intense. And it was in this area where Gorton completely misunderstood the character of the Liberal Party. Because although the drift of power to the centre continued unabated, there was a philosophical attachment to federalism and states' rights inside the Liberal Party, which Menzies understood, Holt understood, but I don't think John Gorton did, and it was one of the things that helped bring him down within his own party. But of course it was a very different Australia then when it came to how people thought about economic issues. Many of you will remember the some say notorious or infamous or whatever famous example of when Henry Bolte used the power he had under the Victorian Companies Act to prevent the takeover of Ansett Transport Industries by TNT and Peter Abels and the others. And then it was, in my view, it was overwhelmingly a parochial Victorian response to something. And now that would now be unthinkable. something like that. When I first started practicing law in the early 1960s, if you registered a company in New South Wales and wanted to carry on business in Victoria, you had to register it in Victoria as a foreign company. That was actually the description. And the registration requirements were almost identical to the registration requirements that you would have to follow if you wanted to register it to carry on business in the United Kingdom. Now, a lot of that has changed, and that is understandable, but all parties have a certain ethos and a certain mythology, and it's important to pay respect to the Federalist principles of a party if it hasn't been. And one point I make in the book that I think is relevant to this very issue: if the Labor Party in 1955 had had the same organisational structure as the Liberal Party then and now, the split would never have occurred. Because in the Liberal Party, the federal executive has no power effectively to turf out a state executive, which the national structure of the Labor Party has always had. And in 1955, there was no way that the group of controlled Victorian executive had put itself into liquidation. Now, sometimes having national authority can be good, but sometimes it can be poisonous. And so occasionally that looser federal arrangement delivers benefits that you otherwise might not have.
Stephen.
Yes, I realise the question I'm going to ask falls in the period before your book starts, before the Rules of Cinema Night, but perhaps falls within answers. But I'm interested to know if you have a view about Mr. Menzies' relationship with John Curtin and his view about Curtin's handling of the war and the involvement of America.
So the question goes back, is it a man of Curtin in your book, it may occur within Anne's book, but the question about Menzies' relationship with Curtin around the time of the beginning of the Second World War.
Most of the evidence that I've seen suggests that they had a better relationship than Menzies would go on to have with Everett. They had a bad relationship. I think it's fair to say that Menzies had quite a cordial relationship with both Curtin and Chifley, and to some degree also with Caldwell. It's also fair to say that, from my reading, that if Curtin had had his way, the Labor Party may have been a little more cooperative about a national government. Menzies wanted to have a national government after the war broke out, an all-party government, that is, and the Labor Party would not agree to that. And my reading suggests that the opposition to it was stronger from people such as Everett and Beazley, no relation to either of the Kims. Jack Beazley, who was a Lang Labor member of the Federal Parliament from New South Wales and who had considerable influence. So, and when Menzies stood down in 1939, there was an exchange of correspondence which Anne deals with very well and very effectively in her book, which indicated that there was a mutuality of respect between the two. I say in the book that in handling their respective parties in that war period, the Curtin proved to be more adept than Menzies. I think perhaps had something to do with the fact that his path to the top had been bumpier and more difficult, and he seemed to have been a more effective reconciler of people within his own party.
Now we're getting very close to the end. There's a question here, then we go down to Stuart. Yep.
So I wondered why Menzies went to London during the war.
The question is, why did Menzies go to London during the war?
Well, for the very good reason that he was alarmed that the vulnerability of Australia's vulnerable position was not fully understood and accepted by the British government. And I think he was absolutely right to go to London during the war. And it's true that he had a lot of arguments with Churchill, who he greatly admired, but nonetheless thought was paying insufficient regard to Australia's vulnerable position. And I think he was quite justified in going.
Stuart.
Menzies' movement of extreme strong support over time from Britain in World War II to the United States in the Vietnam War simply display a sound judgment of geopolitics, or was it something else?
The suggestion is that Menzies' movement from his support for Britain to the, at the time of the Second War to the United States more in the 50s and 60s, was this what he wanted to do, or was it a recognition of the geopolitical reality of the time?
I think Menzies quite shrewdly decided to embrace the reality that at the end of World War II, Britain was prostrated and exhausted. And despite the extraordinary sentiment he had for the country and regard for its institutions, and he would always maintain the British externalities, he understood that he had to see America, as it rightly was then, the leader of the free world. And I think on those issues it's fair to say that although, you know, people always talk about, you know, his regard for the monarchy, which is very real, and all of that, and he was very fond of Britain and remained so for the rest of his life, but he understood the world had changed. I think it was one of the great tributes to him that he was able to, when it came to the crunch, he always made a decision that was in Australia's national interest, and that was certainly the case in the foreign policy stances he took in Asia after the war.
And the two final questions, one there, and we end up with Tony. Yep.
Nuclear weapons. Did Menzies realistically believe that he had a chance of getting them for Australia, and how hard did he try?
Did he want to get nuclear weapons for Australia?
I didn't find any evidence that that was a real aspiration.
Tony.
Briefly, Menzies described the Liberal Party as one of the Liberal Party, not at all a conservative one, yet the commentariat calls the Liberal Party conservative. Do you believe it has changed that dramatically from Menzies' days?
Well, I don't call it a conservative party. I call it a broad church. and I deal with this. I think the Liberal Party is the custodian of two traditions in Australian politics, the conservative tradition and also the classical liberal tradition. It's the party of John Stuart Mill as well as the party of Edmund Burke. And in that sense, it's a little different from other centre-right parties around the world. One of the difficulties with these questions, Tony, is that, and the answers to them, is that the nomenclature has changed. I describe myself as an economic liberal and a social conservative, and I think that was a fair description of what I stood for. An economic conservative is somebody who wouldn't have supported any reforms. An economic conservative is somebody who would oppose industrial relations reform, for example, would oppose tariff reform and all those sorts of things. And you could say that in some respects Menzies was an economic conservative because many of those policies remained in place because they appeared to work at that time. And I deal with this. My second last chapter is called The Great Assumption. There was a great assumption, and it was embodied in Whitlam's policy speech in 1972 when he said, "And how do you think I'm going to pay for all of this largesse?" He said, "Out of the proceeds of the automatic increase in taxation revenue from a constantly growing economy." And everybody thought the world would just continue to deliver that. And then that all suddenly changed in the early 70s with the quadrupling of oil prices and the end of Bretton Woods and the like. But look, I am a broad church man, and you know, the pews should be very expansive.
As a broad church man, we've got room for two more questions.
Yeah.
One from the Church of Barry O'Farrell and one from the Church of Anthony Benchka. Okay, so Barry.
John, very happy to pray with you any time, but can I thank you firstly for the book in particular, for your highlighting of Menzies' engagement with Asia. But can I bring you to modern day events? Last Friday, I took my youngest son to Belmore to enjoy Grand Final week. Saw Australians of Arabic, European, Greek, Chinese, Indian backgrounds, a fun, festive occasion, and people of all different religions. I go home to Tarramurra and get a letter telling me that my son can't attend his Upper North Shore school wearing his Army Cadet uniform.
Well, that's crazy.
Has the advocates of Terra One, when we're changing our lifestyle in an area of Sydney that's greatest brushed with anarchism, is when the Hendersons live at Hornsby?
I am staggered to hear that, and I think that is a failure. That is an oversensitivity. And
Macron didn't pick it up. There's the suggestion that the children in Warringah are told not to, young men in Warringah are told not to wear their cadet uniform. Right?
Yeah, well, that is just crazy. I think that's an indictment of the people who gave that instruction. They should be an absolute indictment, and it's a total overreaction to what is essentially a non-problem.
Anthony, final question.
John, thank you. Do you have another book in you?
Well, I was asked this question before, and I said that if the sales of this book exceeded the sales of Lazarus Rising, I might be willing to consider it. So there's a challenge if you want another book. If you don't want another book, then you don't buy it, you see.
Many thanks. Just... Well, there are a lot of people here, and I'll be brief. As I said, there's some copies of John Howard, The Menzies Era. I just should say briefly, I think it's great that Mr. Howard has bought into the current debate about his own government, but about the very significant Menzies government of an earlier era. He's covered, the book arrived only on Friday, I think you might say with a thud, because there's a lot in it, and it's having looked through it's very important that it covers a lot of the period through the 50s into the 60s, which now is sort of ancient history, but very important history, and then goes on to pretty well the contemporary time, or certainly the recent time. So I think it's great that John Howard's been able to put his thoughts down on paper on this, and I'm sure there will be another book in him. So, and then when that occurs, he'll be back at the Sydney Institute. But until then, thank you and well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.